WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Today, we're talking about Francis Ford Coppola and his movie Apocalypse Now Redux. Terry Gross spoke with the filmmaker in 1997.
I'm interested in some things about your family. I think it was your maternal grandfather who actually owned several movie theaters. What years did he own them? Were you alive?
No, this would be really in the 20s, I would guess. And in fact, they not only owned some theaters, and theaters that catered pretty much to Italian-American audiences, but they lived on top of it, and so all the family would have different jobs. My grandmother would take the tickets, and the younger, mischievous brother, Victor, you know, people in those days used to put their babies in the lobby, and so that he would walk through and say, baby crying, and, you know, they would really run these little theaters. And then from that, he actually began to go to Italy and acquire some films for Italian-American distribution in his company. Also, he did music roles, because primarily he was a songwriter and a composer, and a wonderful one, I think. And his music role company was called Paramount Music Roles. And some of his friends in that time, in the 20s, were becoming involved in a movie studio. And as the story goes, they were talking to him and looking for a name, and he suggested, we'll call it Paramunto. And that was Balaban and Katz, who later were the partners in what later became Paramount.
That's quite a brush with early movie history.
Well, I have on the other side another interesting story. My other grandfather, Carmine Coppola's grandfather, Augustino, was a very fine engineer and tool and die maker, made mechanical things, and he was called upon to engineer and build a new device that turned out to be the Vitaphone, which was the first sound talkie movie that when they made The Jazz Singer, with Al Jolson, it was, and there's in our museum, there's a beautiful museum in the winery, and there's a picture of him with the Vitaphone that he's just built.
Can you sing a verse of a song that your grandfather wrote?
Well, sure, I'll always sing for you. In The Godfather, there was a whole sequence in a little Italian-American music hall where they sang a song that was called Senza Mamma, and it went sort of like, Senza mamma, a quanta foresta parola ancora. Senza, it's all about crying because he ran off with a sort of a woman of no account, and then his mother died.
So that was your grandfather's song?
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
That's a Neapolitan song.
Huh. So I think it was your grandfather who gave you, a 16-millimeter projector when you were a boy?
That's right. '49, I had polio and I was paralyzed for a year, and he did bring me a kind of 16-millimeter projector. It was a young people's projector. It wasn't a, you know, serious. I mean, it was a real working 16-millimeter projector, but it was of toy quality. But I used to certainly love that.
So, what did you project in it?
Well, unfortunately, because it was 16-millimeter, there were only the couple of little film clips that I had. Most of what film I could play with was an 8-millimeter, and there I had a number of cartoons and some home movies. And also my father had one of the very early tape recorders, the Ecor home tape recorder, and I had it by my bed when I was in that period of being paralyzed, and I used to try to make soundtracks and synchronize them to make them play in sync with the movies.
And what would be on the soundtracks?
Well, it would be stuff like, here we go, hey, Mickey, no, watch out, the fire. It was like that.
So how paralyzed were you?
Well, I couldn't walk, and I couldn't move my left arm.
So you spent a year basically away from the rest of the world.
I was in a bedroom on the second floor. You know, in those days, people were very, very frightened of polio as a children's contagious disease, so I didn't certainly see any kids. I saw my brother and my sister, and I had a television. One of my great frustrations, of course, this is before remote control, was that I wasn't able to get up to change the channel. But I had my favorite shows. There was one called The Children's Hour that Horn and Hardock used to do with lots of talented kids singing and dancing. And I loved that and some puppet shows.
So did you have any sense at this age that you actually were getting serious about movies?
No, I didn't have a very, important view of myself. I was, I had been always moved many, many schools, so I always kind of was a little bit of a loner, and I had extraordinarily talented and, really a kind of winner older brother who was very kind to me, but pretty much was the star of the family. And so I never thought of myself as, I wasn't good at school, and I wasn't particularly as, my family was very good looking, all of them. And, I was the affectionate one. I wasn't as good looking as the others.
It must have been interesting for you to eventually go from, being paralyzed for a year alone at home in your bed to, being such the center of attention and so famous.
It was totally an accident. It happened because I sort of was a little bit of a boy scientist, and I was very interested. I used to stay by myself in the basement or the garage, whatever, since we moved a lot, whatever little shop I could set up. And it was my interest in science and electricity and that got me kind of working on lights and on theater. And then I think my older brother was a writer, and because of him I heard about things related to literature, and I pretty much wanted to emulate him. So the combination of being interested in stories and literature and lights and theater, and I must say girls, because the girls were at the theater department or the football team.
Right.
So I wanted to, I always was a little bit of an outcast socially because I was the new kid. And I felt if I could hang out at the theater, and of course theater always needs volunteers, and if I was willing to, work and unravel the cable or help build the sets, I could be included in the group.
Your father, Carmine Coppola, who wrote music for The Godfather and for the restoration of Napoleon, was, a professional musician throughout his life, and certainly, while you were growing up. He was a flutist with an orchestra. He played for a while with Radio City Music Hall, accompanying the Rockettes. What were some of the things that seemed really exciting to you about his work?
Well, the most dramatic part of that period as a child was that he was the solo flutist for Toscanini in the NBC Symphony Orchestra. So all during the time that I was a small child, it was a very prestigious, and we were occasionally, there'd be articles in the newspaper about him, and so we knew there was something important going on. Although when I was really little, I used to go around telling everyone that my father was a magician, because I had heard he was a magician, but I got it wrong. He was a musician. I remember one incident that is very vivid in my mind. They took me to the studio and radio in RCA Studio 8H, where the big orchestra and Toscanini with his white hair and black turtleneck was, and I was brought as a 5-year-old in a little glass booth, and I was very intrigued because there was a knob in the booth, and when you turned it all the way to the left, you would hear the orchestra, and when you turned it to the right, you couldn't hear the orchestra. I think that's when I first realized as a concept that sound and picture are not necessarily connected.
Two of your movies have been war movies, Patton and Apocalypse Now. Were you ever drafted?
No, but one of my school experiences was at a military school. I was at New York Military Academy in high school for a couple of years, and of course I played in the military band, but I was a full out cadet, and so I knew a lot about, really in a funny way, cadet life, which of course it was a place up there right next to West Point, and I was very good at drill, and I knew all about military organization and stuff like that.
So you liked it?
I did like it. After a while, I felt a little isolated there when an older roommate graduated. He was someone who was, reading James Joyce's Ulysses, and he was a kind of pretty interesting fellow. He was also the only Jewish guy in the school, and I admired him. And then the next year, I kind of felt very isolated and wanted to do interesting things with the theater group there, and they didn't want me to, and I finally ran away.
Ran away from school?
Ran away from military school.
Oh, my gosh. Were you caught?
Well, I did it very effectively. I just called a cab.
Well, what happened?
I wandered around New York, scared to go home, because my father was on the road with a Broadway show, with a touring show, and I wandered around New York, and I had sold my uniforms to some guy who's brother was going to come next year, and I had a couple $100s, and I sort of lived this very strange wandering around New York and seeing things I'd never seen before. And then when I got home to where my brother was living with his wife, he said, I told him what had happened. He said, here, read this book. And I read The Catcher in the Rye, and I said, hey, I just did this. I wrote a letter to J.D. Salinger after reading it, and I said in the letter, you know, I'm 16 and I want to be a filmmaker, and I've just lived something so much like your book that I know I would do a good job. I wish you would please let me have the rights to make Catcher in the Rye.
Oh, that's a scream. I'm sure you got a lot of response from J.D. Salinger.
Yeah, zero.
Yeah.
Terry Gross spoke with filmmaker Francis Ford Coppola in 1997. This is Fresh Air.